Hello, and welcome to episode 23 of the Decarceration Nation podcast, a podcast about radically reimagining America's criminal justice system. I'm Josh Ho. Among other things, I am formerly incarcerated, a freelance writer, criminal justice reform advocate, and the author of the book, Writing Your Own Best Story, Addiction and Living Hope. First, the news. I had a great time this week as one of the trainers at the Michigan Council on Crime and Delinquency event, which was training social workers who work with incarcerated and formerly incarcerated populations. I also published an article about the Supreme Court situation and an article about solitary confinement. Some of my upcoming interviews include, as I've mentioned before, an interview with Donna Hilton, the author of the book A Little Piece of Light. I was very excited recently to get confirmation that I'm going to interview James Forman Jr., who won the Pulitzer Prize for his book Locking Up Our Own recently. I also have a few other interviews that I'm working on setting up as we speak, so hopefully a lot of exciting stuff coming. Okay, let's get to this week's interviews with the folks behind the documentary Knife Skills. I'm incredibly excited to welcome the folks behind the Oscar-nominated documentary Knife Skills to the Decarceration Nation podcast today. Knife Skills is a documentary about a restaurant in Cleveland, Ohio, but not just any restaurant. It's a high-end French restaurant built on a business model which gives formerly incarcerated people the transferable and sustainable skills necessary to work in fine dining. If you have not seen the documentary, you absolutely should. It's only about 40 minutes long. I've seen it about 10 times, and if anyone walked into the room right now and said, let's watch Knife Skills again, I would be all in. I will include a link to the documentary in the show notes. Seriously, it's a great documentary. You should check it out. So anyway, who are my two actual guests? My first guest is Thomas F. Lennon, who should not be confused with Thomas P. Lennon. He's a winner of two Peabody Awards and an Academy Award as a documentarian. In an odd coincidence, he also created another of my favorite documentaries, The Battle Over Citizen Kane. My second guest is Brandon Krasowski, the person who started Edwin's, the restaurant and the Institute, but he is doing much more. He's also been doing in-reach and training and mentoring inside prisons in Ohio. To give you a feeling for what he stands for, in his TED Talk, he said his projects are about revitalizing communities and reuniting families, something I couldn't agree with more. Hello, gentlemen, and welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Josh, thank you.
Great to be here.
I'm going to try to do this a bit chronologically at first. So the first few questions will be for Brandon. But Thomas, if you have something to add, feel free. Brandon, towards the end of the documentary, in a scene that always hits me really hard, you talk about your son being named Leonard after your grandfather, but also after the patron saint of prisoners. Can you talk a little bit about your journey and where your passion to help prisoners began?
Yeah, absolutely. It was really began in 98 when I graduated high school. That was the same time that I got thrown in jail and was facing some pretty hard time, 5 to 10 years. I was fortunate enough to get probation and really a second life be handed. And from that point on, it was really just great mentorship and the idea of having the right fundamentals to work anywhere that I wish. But that all goes back to, you know, being a younger man. And facing that sort of that realization that freedom it doesn't come for nothing.
And so when you decide to pay that forward, what really was, I mean, you just it just became a passion for you, or was there more of a story or genesis to it?
Sure. The idea really didn't hit me until 2004. This was after having worked in Charlie Trotter's kitchen. Having gone to school at the Culinary Institute of America, having worked in Paris, and then I was actually at a restaurant in Manhattan called Le Cirque. And this is when the idea hit to do something bigger, to pay it forward, as people say. There was men and women back home in Detroit, you know, mentors of mine, the men who helped me become a man, that were getting killed, murdered, thrown in prison. And I just couldn't help but think that I was here, and they, in fact, were not. That's really the genesis or the inspiration that set this whole project in motion.
Okay. And so of course the next question is, how was Edwin's itself born?
Well, I mean, again, if you go back to that story from that break, that mentorship, and then, you know, just kind of working on that path to create something for others. So it was really, you know, it was just really born through hard work, an idea, this idea that it worked in my life, it could work for others. But you know, when the restaurant opened, I mean, how that all became born. It started in prisons in 2011, and that just came simply by knocking on a prison warden's door and saying, "Hey, I'd like to teach a class." And from there, I was developing that into what this is ultimately supposed to be, which was a school, a restaurant, a campus, and so on. That all just came within, you know, just throughout time.
Can I jump in as somebody who spent a lot of time with Brandon, and what I found is that the people who were in the restaurant, who were trainees, who were, you know, fighting for a second opportunity for themselves, were very, very open about their lives. But Brandon kept his cards closer to the vest, and it took maybe 6 months to a year of me doing filming in the restaurant and spending a lot of time there before I came to understand a branded story. And I think he's, you know, appropriately downplaying it a little bit. Two things I want to say, which is that I met people ultimately who had known Brandon in his early 20s. It is so like 10 years before he opened Edwin's, he was already telling friends that he had this idea about this restaurant that would be staffed entirely by people, men and women, just out of incarceration. So this was a long plan coming, and a passion that had stayed with him a long time. The other thing that it took me a long time to understand, and actually I didn't really do justice to in the film, but because it's something that Brandon talks about very little, but I think is important to understand, which is personal faith. He doesn't talk about it at all in the restaurant setting or in prison. He just gets on with the business. But I think personal faith was important to him, and I think personal faith I found was very important to a lot of the people who were fighting for a second life after they got out of jail or prison.
I would certainly co-sign on that myself. So one of the things that we're really interested in as a general principle with this podcast is the notion of how people can build systems like this that help people with reentry. So how in the world did you get buy-in from investors, stakeholders, the city of Cleveland, the state of Ohio, the governor, et cetera, the wardens, to support a restaurant and institute based entirely around a reentry model?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question, Josh. It just took time. I think it's first and foremost, it took time and effort and sacrifice, which I think was the ultimate selling point when someone looked at me and said, "Hey, you know, either he's crazy or he's really onto something." That would be one.
Or possibly both.
Two, the idea that there was a very solid plan. The first thing was there was a Loctite business plan. I had a you know curriculum attached to this that was that was bulletproof. There was partnerships in place that were already being worked. You know, wherever the restaurants that I ran, I would, you know, in Cleveland, I would have men and women coming out of prison staff them. So there was already a track record of this happening. And then, you know, to push it further, the program in prison was taking place. Then I started doing this in a women's prison. And when people took notice, they said, "Hey, you know, this is the real thing. And if in fact it can go a little further, maybe it could do that much more." I don't think anyone envisioned around me this idea that we could take it this far. But it always felt natural that we could do this, you know, simply by taking someone's potential and pushing it forward. That's how.
Can I jump in also and to say, look, I'm not trying to toot Brandon's horn here at all, but I again, a few things that I think are relevant. First of all, go back to what I said about 10 years before he had decided this was something he wanted to do, right? And again, this is all stuff I learned months into the filming. But he apprenticed in these very, very, very fancy establishments in Chicago, New York, even Paris. That's in fact how I met him, because I happened to be family friends with a very well known chef in New York, and that's how I was lucky enough to meet Brandon before he'd opened the restaurant, which gave me a chance to sort of film from the ground up. So there was a determination, and then a kind of a building up of credentials. And then, as Brandon, correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand it, you sort of said, okay, what's the city that needs this kind of a program? This was when you were living in New York, and sort of said, okay, lots of dropouts in Cleveland. High school dropouts has got a high correlation between high school dropout and crime problems. How about I set it up in Cleveland? Then managing a restaurant in Cleveland, developing a real following in Cleveland. This is a restaurant that had nothing to do with incarceration, but again, gave him the cred to then go to investors and say, okay, here's the next plan. So it's, you know, for a guy who's, I mean, you'll see, anybody who watches the film will see that this is a pretty eccentric venture and a pretty eccentric founder of a restaurant, but at the same time, very strategic.
Did you have anything to?
Yeah. Hey, Josh, until you invest in yourself, you're less likely that people invest in you. So I was just taking as much investment as I could without making the, you know, without purchasing a restaurant and so on. So the nonprofit and so on. I mean, people start to see a solid plan, self-investment, it actually being done, and then that's when the first person just gave, and that person, you know, started the domino effect.
That's awesome. Are the people you recruited for that first class in 2014, were they still on paper, or were they finished with parole and probation?
It was a mix.
So yeah, you had to have buy-in from the parole department in Ohio and.
Yeah, I think as you pass this cookie down, there's some, you know, individual POs are making their discretion upon the person that they know best and what might work best for them. And you think about it, we're all reasonable people on this podcast and probably listening. Who's going to really say no to, you know, a free training program that could help better one's future, as opposed to the current track sometimes people are on, which is searching for employment or, you know, just trying to get some traction in society. So, I mean, that wasn't the hard sell. That really was a pretty easy sell.
I don't know. I've seen some pretty some parole agents that weren't necessarily following a rational course, but I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
So okay, now that we've set the scene, Thomas. First, I wasn't kidding. I own that Wells documentary and have watched it many times. It's one of my favorites.
Wow, I love it.
Yeah,
that's from the long, long ago past, 1996.
Yeah, yeah, but it's about one of the greatest movies of all time, and it, you know, it's part of the Criterion box set, so that's why I have it. Yeah. But how or when did you get involved and how did you start the process that became Knife Skill?
Pure luck, which is, you know, my wife is family friends with a woman who's married to a really, really big chef in New York, David Waltuck. He used to run Chanterelle, which was up in the top five restaurants in New York for, you know, 20 years. And turns out that as Brandon was trying to train and get and learn from the best and apprentice with the best, he spent a couple of years working for Karen and David Waltuck. I didn't know any of that. I got invited to dinner. I thought it was just going to be my wife and David and Karen and me. But there was this other guy there, and it was Brandon, and he was kind of – I couldn't quite get a read on him. But at one point, he sort of like said, well, I'm going to be opening the greatest French restaurant in the United States. And nice. I went like, okay. And he said, it's going to be in Cleveland. That was, you know, a little bit of a surprise. We New York snobs. We figure either it's going to be, you know, East Coast or West Coast. But he said Cleveland. And he said, and it's going to be staffed by people just out of prison. And I mean, I hadn't even finished my appetizer, and I knew that was a film. But as I said, the great luck was that I was having this conversation with him. He said, I'm about to sign a lease. So this was in the summer of 2013, and he was going to open in September, October. And I was free, and I just had bought a new camera. And I was, I said to him, well, how would you feel if I just came out? And started hanging around a little bit. And that was the beginning. I think the film would not have been as strong if the all the kinks had been worked out. You know, I went back there recently a few months ago, and it's a very well-oiled machine now. Everybody knows their part. Everybody knows what they're doing. Not everybody knows what they're doing all the time, but, you know, it's It's much more smoothly running, which is good for the restaurant, but would have been bad for the film.
So can either of you explain one of the things I wondered about every time I've seen the documentary, and that is the seemingly compressed 6-week timeline that's referred to throughout?
Oh, that's okay. Let me first of all explain to listeners what Josh is referring to is that when you that after the people come off come into the program, most of whom have not done any work at all in a restaurant, the restaurant has to be open 6 weeks later. 6 weeks later, Brandon announces they're going to open their doors, and there are different explanations for that. Brandon will have a different one. I think it's because Brandon was crazy.
Is that fair, Brandon?
it's called you know, the cash on hand and how fast it goes.
Gotcha.
There was a desperate timeline. I mean, I knew how much cash that we had on hand. I also knew if we didn't hit this point in the fourth quarter, we'd be dead in the water. So it was a little bit, you know, a lot of business sense, but also something happens when your back's against the wall. There's also something special in humans that happens when you push someone against the wall and they have to do something to survive, and that's also gets some special energy out of it. So there's a calculation behind it.
Yeah, I actually went after watching the documentary. I didn't know you, but what I got from the documentary, I thought the theory might have been pressure makes diamonds. Yeah,
I think there was that, a little of that. And I, you know, I'm supposed to be the fly on the wall. I'm supposed to be the well-trained journalist who just observes. And but I say to Brandon, I said, I think you're nuts. You know, you've got a good idea, but you're starting too soon. And the business calculation was that the trainees came in early in October, or maybe that last week in September, and the best time for a restaurant, a restaurant makes most of its money leading up to Thanksgiving and then through Christmas and into the new year. That's the golden time. So Brandon didn't want to miss that, and I understand that. But it put unbelievable pressure on everybody involved, which was exciting for me as a filmmaker, but I was really biting my nails. I didn't think it was going to work.
I think there was someone else who was really looked throughout the documentary a bit like they were freaked out by that. And that was Gilbert.
Oh, man. And I was interviewing them. And so when the camera wasn't rolling, Gilbert would say to me, "Oh, man, this is crazy. This is Brandon. He's out of his fucking mind. This is absolutely crazy. This is going to be a disaster." And then I'd go, "Okay, yeah, I think we should talk a little bit about that." So I turn on the recorder and he goes, "Well, I think it's interesting, but there's going to be some pressure. We're going to do the best we can." You know, I was like, "Gilbert, come on."
Which leads me to a question. I wanted to talk a little bit about the characters in the documentary, and one of the ones who says the least but has some of the best expressions in the movie is Gilbert. Can you explain how Gilbert came to Edwin's and how you sold him on the business model?
So, Brandon, I had this small office space somebody let me use in a section of Cleveland called Little Italy, and Gilbert had a restaurant. He had owned a restaurant across the street there in Little Italy. So after I'd run this restaurant here in Cleveland from like, you know, midnight till 2 or 3 a.m., I'd work on the Edwin's project at this office space. And obviously he'd be done with, you know, service, and he'd walk by, and every now and then he'd pop his head in and ask me what I'm doing. And towards, you know, a month or two into this, he said, "Hey, well, what do you think? What's going on? How's this going to work?" And he wanted to get into teaching more often. And I said, "Hey, you'd be a great teacher. You're a great chef," and so on. And so he was looking for a place he could kind of step off the gas a bit more, and not own, but also give back what he has learned. So that's how we kicked it off, and then we just started going.
And Thomas, what were your feelings of your interactions with Gilbert?
Well, when he gets introduced in the film, there's a guy listening to him, one of the people just out of prison, who says, "First, you're just amazed listening to this guy. This is a chef that sounds like he's something out of TV or the movies." So my first reaction was really, just as a filmmaker, I just thought, man, this guy is heaven sent to me, you know, because he talks like this. He's gruff, he's angry all the time, he swears all the time. And but he loved those trainees, and they could feel his love for them, and they loved him back. He's a really amazing character, and the connection between him and those trainees was amazing. He's one of the very few people in the program who hadn't had any brush with the law, at least that I know of. At least that's not why he was there. So I didn't feature him heavily in terms of his backstory, but an amazing guy and very important to the film.
So one of the compliments I would definitely give to you, Thomas, is that for a short documentary, I really ended up feeling like I knew many of the people in the film: Alan, Marley, Dorian, Mike, and Dowdy, and of course Brandon a little bit. So what drew you to these folks, and where are we with their story? Are they, you know, it's been a few years.
Yeah. Let me first of all say that the film was actually, I don't think it plays this way, but it was actually very difficult to make. And part of why it was difficult to make is that I wanted to introduce you to a lot of different people. I didn't want to make this a story about any one person. I wanted to make it a story about what it's like to come out of prison and build a new life. That involved jumping around from one person to the next. And yet I still wanted you to feel really connected to everybody. And I want to do it in a short period of time. And a short period of running time. I want to keep the film short. You know, Billie Holiday said to, when people said like, oh, what advice do you have for me as a singer? She said, get off the stage while people are still shouting for another song. You know, so that's my view. Like, get off the stage while people still want to know more. And there's a lot that I leave out of the film, but I think that hopefully just leaves you hungry, not just for Edwin's delicious food, but to know more about the folks. So I thank you for that comment, because that's really what the film was all about, was how can I make you care about people without spending a lot of time with them, or any more than I have to. Now, actually, everybody in the film is, you know, really doing well. There's only one person you got to know there who's not in food, and that's Dorian, the guy who has the fight with Brandon, not physical fight, but a verbal clash with Brandon in the middle of the program. And he is doing great, but he decided after he dropped out of the program, he got a great job in manufacturing and stayed with it. But he loved that time that he was there at the restaurant and looks back on it with a lot of pride. Everybody else is A, doing well, and B, earning their living in food.
That's awesome.
Isn't it awesome?
And this leads me back to Brandon. I think probably my favorite moment of the film isn't really about the graduation. It's before that. There's a scene where one of the people who we get to know in the film is back in court and has been picked up for another offense. And the camera pans and Brandon's in the courtroom, which says a lot to anyone like me who's formerly incarcerated. And at the end, during graduation, you mention this, Brandon, and you say, in the end, we still have their backs. We visit them downtown. We send them books. They are part of a family, and this family won't be broken. I promise you that. And I think for anyone like me who's been through this process, just hearing anyone say that is incredibly powerful. And I just want to thank you for that and also ask you, you know, where this kind of rock hard, solid commitment. I know I've asked you this a couple ways before, but really...
Ask again, Josh. Maybe I'll go.
If you could talk a little bit about that, because that spoke so powerfully to me.
Yeah. Well, you know, Josh, I think that you've been down that road and being in those shoes, you know what it feels like. So if given the strength and given the talent, you know, you only feel compelled to do it, right? I mean, I feel like it's a responsibility to have some things that maybe others don't. But knowing what it feels like to not have or to be without, that's where that strong conviction of having, you know, having someone's back comes from. I feel like I just
had an insight that just now while I was listening that I want to add, which is, you know, Brandon said like, well, why did he create such a short time between when the people entered the program and when they had that restaurant had to open? He said, sometimes when people's backs are against the wall, that's when they come up that's when they come up with their best stuff, or when they come up with more than they thought they had. I just realized this obvious thing. Brandon loves to have his back up against the wall. And it's not just that he's doing it to the other people in the program, but he's doing it to himself. And you know, if I think there's a testing of self that is involved in always expanding the mission. It took me a long, long time to finish this film because I had to make my money doing something else, because I was doing some other projects, because I wasn't making any money on this film, and I had to raise money, and then the edit, as I said, was difficult. And, you know, I started like using my phone ID to avoid picking up any calls from Brandon, because he's one of the most impatient people in the whole world, and he always wants something to happen the next day. And I had to say to him, well, I don't know exactly when I'm going to finish. I don't know. And after saying that about seven times, I just like started ducking the calls. We all like to push ourselves, and something exciting happens when you expand your own mission. You know, and I still don't know what Brandon's really like. He spent 10 years plotting this thing, and now that restaurant is a success, and the message is getting out to a wider audience. So what's the next 10 years going to be? I don't think I know. I don't think Brandon knows, but I think it's going to be fun to watch.
So that brings us to the question of how is the Edwin's Institute and how's the Edwin's restaurant doing now?
Good, Josh. I mean, we're thriving. This is gonna be our most powerful year ever in terms of bottom line. So we are keeping the seats filled. We're now into 13 different prisons with our culinary clubs, where we empower inmates to be able to teach, what we guide them through. We still teach that hands-on class in Grafton Prison. This is all still going on today. We finished a campus. You know, after that first year, it was apparent that housing had to take place. So we have a campus three blocks away. So there's free housing for current students. There is a...
Seriously?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's 22 beds. I've got a second building for 8 beds for alumni. There's a fitness center, library, and test kitchen. So that's all been complete since 2015. And just this week started construction on the butcher shop. So the idea is to continue to take our supply chain, build out these little ecosystems where our students can go through, learn that skill trait to the top in an environment that's all that skill. It also, increases our bottom line because we're selling to ourselves wholesale. And, I only build in the hood. So it's given the community something that they so much deserve. So that's Butcher Shop. That'll be this winter complete and functioning. And the idea is to do that with a bakery, a fish shop and so on all the way down the road. So, Bill.
Wow.
Man, wow. I
didn't know. I didn't know about the bakery and the fish shop. That's so cool.
To me, what's amazing.
Well, the idea is to build the best culinary school, in the country, done so by men and women out of prison, just, showing the world that, hey, look, we're not discounted. We're not individuals who just, who are less, we in fact are doing the best and more in society.
So Brandon, in Michigan recently, we've had a lot of problems. First, they privatized the prison food service for many years. Now they've gone back from that, and they were asking or they were starting to look at different models. Is this model that you're building transportable? Do you feel like that it could be a model for other states?
Well, absolutely. 3 months ago, just opened a restaurant in a place called Medina. So there's the two judges, the probation department, asked if I could come down there and start the same project. And so put the full weight behind that. We opened up. And so that's a restaurant for people in recovery. We just got actually yesterday, Tom, you may not know this, but the plane dealer reviewed us 4 out of 4 stars.
I saw that.
So, it's possible, and it can be done at a higher level of quality so that you're always employable. I mean, we've got 54 jobs waiting to hire. We got 1% recidivism. I mean, when you graduate this program, you're strong enough, you're smart enough, and you've got what it takes to succeed in this business and in life. So it is exportable. It certainly is. It just takes the right group of leaders and leadership to see it through.
Have you considered almost having some kind of class or a handbook or something that could be given to other leaders in other states that might be able to work to reproduce this?
Can I jump in and say one thing about that?
Sure.
You know, Brandon and I circled around each other a little bit warily during this project. He wasn't eager to reveal much about himself, and he wasn't really eager to, if you notice in the film, the first time he really talks about himself, he says, okay, turn off the camera and let's talk, you know?
Yeah.
So he was careful, but again, go back to that strategic sense that I said, why did he let me in? I think it's clear that he wanted to, that he figured, okay, this guy has some credibility as a filmmaker. Maybe it'll get my message out wider.
Yep.
I think that's the only reason I was allowed in.
And in doing so, Josh, in doing so with integrity, there's been a number of networks and sharks that want to, you know, just capitalize on some, you know, drama. You know, here's someone who can portray it in a way that helps others understand this difficulty of coming home and the work that needs to be done and that can be done.
Yeah, it seemed
so for sure.
So I guess what I'm saying is I think the film is a little bit of that handbook that you're talking about, Josh. You know, and not that it's adequate, but I'm saying it's a thing to get people interested in replicating the model elsewhere.
So Josh, I've got 22 hours of the classes have been taped, edited, and developed around this. You know, I got like a 250 page curriculum that's bound. I mean, everything here is exportable, but again, it doesn't matter what you export. It's the individuals who are able to execute that plan. So, I mean, it's here, not the blueprint on how to build it, because it's case by case. But the curriculum is definitely, you know, packaged, ready to go.
That's awesome. I'm just so impressed by this whole project. I mean, I've heard a lot of different reentry models and inreach models, but I haven't heard one that is providing jobs, creating housing, creating larger transportable skill sets. I just can't tell you how blown away I am by what you're building there. And I guess that's a good enough place to stop. No?
No, okay. No, it isn't. Because, Josh, I want to ask you what you're building. Because I'm very impressed with all the prep you did on this, and you chased me relentlessly because I was a pain in the neck to get to agree. But you've got your own story and you've got your own message that you're coming out. What are you building?
Well, I mean, I say that this is a podcast about radically reimagining America's criminal justice system, and to some extent that's true because I went through it as a privileged person who had an education, and I saw all of the things that I could maybe work my way around, but nobody else could.
Right.
And
right.
So to me, right, it became, I mean, a lot of people say that the people left behind are their brothers and sisters. I literally see them as my brothers and sisters. And so the most important thing to me every day is what I'm doing for people on the inside and for people coming back. And it sounds like Brandon is just a lot better at it than I am.
Well, this, you know, podcasts are a very important tool, and I salute you for what you're doing. But I think that there is a lot of work to be done, and I'm glad you're in the trenches.
Thanks, man. And Brandon, like I said, I can't tell you how much I admire what you're doing, and thanks for coming on and talking about it.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
It was really fun. Really fun.
And last thing I'll say is there's several of us in the reform community here who have been talking for at least a couple of months about coming to Edwin, so don't be surprised if you see us.
Come on down.
I should have a percentage, man. I'm really booming the business of that damn restaurant. But what do I get from it? Nothing.
Yeah. Well, your name is on the movie.
I'm teasing.
I know.
Well, thank you, Josh.
All right, guys.
All right, pleasure.
Thanks so much, guys.
Bye-bye.
Okay, and thanks so much to Brandon and Thomas for joining me for that interview. Now my take. Since January, when I started this podcast, one of the things that I've said over and over and over again is that we need a reentry system or reentry systems that start immediately after someone is sentenced to prison or jail, and then only after someone has a safe place to live, a job with a living wage and health insurance, and where they are reconnecting with their communities. In the past, I have said that prison reentry should operate like a hospital, where the administration of that prison or jail's main concern from the minute someone enters is how to ensure that that person returns as quickly and successfully as possible. When I left prison, my counselor, and in prison we have these things, they're called ARUSs in Michigan, but they're counselors. In theory, they're supposed to help you. But when I left prison, my counselor, despite multiple planning meetings, released me to the wrong county. I'm not kidding you. I ended up being in a county I had never lived in, where I had to report and I had to find a place to live on the fly. Well, they had a place for me, like a halfway house. And I had to figure out where it was, and I had to get there, and then I had to get to the office. I'd never been in that county before in my life, and I'd been planning, and everything I'd done to set up everything was set in the county where I actually lived. It was insane. In addition, I had zero reentry assistance, no help with jobs, no training while in prison, and I was expected to simply overcome employment discrimination, housing discrimination, and make connections in my community on my own. There were some programs, like I had to go to therapy, but mostly I was locked in my house all the time and was only let out to get food, get a job, or work. So the idea, it speaks very deeply to me to think of reentry in a different way. I am blown away by what Brandon is doing in Ohio. He is starting to teach people while they are in prison. He is hiring folks when they leave jails and prisons. He is providing them with skills that they can take anywhere in the world. And remember, he has worked in Paris, in New York, in, you know, all over the world. And he is even building in housing for folks so that when they get out, they have somewhere to live until they can acquire housing for themselves. I suspect that he's made all this happen in a political environment where folks were not exactly tripping over themselves to help him build a better reentry system. But he somehow made it work and got the buy-in from all the important stakeholders. And according to Thomas, he created this vision well before Brandon created this vision well before he ever settled on building a restaurant in, as he puts it, the hood in Cleveland, Ohio, before Edwin's even existed. He didn't wait for the government to do something. He made it happen, and as a result, thousands of people in Ohio are coming back from prison or jail to a real chance at a better life. And most important, as long as you can find a Brandon, and while he is clearly one in a million, there are millions of hungry, formerly incarcerated folks. What he is building could be built anywhere. He's even made manuals. And why wouldn't we want that? Thousands of people come out of jail or prison to a meaningful job and a chance at a better life, and all with a 1% recidivism rate. What Brandon is doing is amazing. The term paying it forward barely does his project justice. I think you can hear in the interview how shocked and amazed I was by what he is pulling off. There are people all over the country accomplishing parts of what Brandon is doing, but I have seen very few people do it all. This is the first time I've seen the entire model, an entire cradle, pardon the phrase, cradle to grave reentry model, and to do it all from scratch with only some chutzpah, some training, and a plan. I just am blown away by what he has accomplished. I guess at the end of the day, I just want to thank Brandon for all he is doing. I know I am thinking about ways to take what he has done to apply it all in my home state of Michigan. I've already started making calls and talking with people. And I want to also say that a lot of what I'm doing, getting these interviews, making connections with people all over the country, making connections in Michigan for criminal justice reform is stuff that all of us can do as incarcerated, formerly incarcerated people when we get the opportunity. I record this podcast from my one room in a boarding house. This microphone I used cost, I think, $30 a couple years ago. I use a laptop that I think is like 8 years old. I pay $15 for hosting. I don't have, at the end of the day, I'm still getting, to talk to, a lot of the people who are writing the critical books in this area or doing the work, like, or people with their sleeves rolled up and actually making change in states like Ohio. And I'm connecting with legislators and I'm talking to national leaders. And you can do that too. We all can do that. If you're a family member of someone who's incarcerated, I can't tell you how many people I have met who are doing incredible work all over the country as a family member. The whole point of this project is not just to talk about radically reimagining America's criminal justice system. It is to change America's criminal justice system for the better. And the way we do that is by all working together, all connecting, all becoming a decarceration nation. That is the real goal of this thing. And so I really hope that we all connect. You know, find me on social media. Find me, you know, if you have questions about what I'm doing or if you have things you're doing that you want to share with me, find me on social media. Find me on our website. Leave comments. Do whatever you got to do. Let's get together and build this thing so wherever you are and wherever I am, we can take what's working in, you know, all over this country and we can push legislators and we can connect to each other so that we have more of a chance to be persuasive with legislators. And when they don't want to cooperate, we just start doing it ourselves, like what Brandon is doing. Let's make this happen. Let's create this nation. That's all I got for today. As always, you can find the show notes or leave us a comment at decarceration.nation.com. If you want to support the podcast directly, you can do so from patreon.com/onpiratesatellite. That's all one word. You can also support us by leaving a 5-star review from iTunes or like us on Stitcher or Spotify. Thanks so much for listening to the Decarceration Nation podcast. I also, again, want to give a special thanks to Thomas and to Brandon. I can't tell you how much this interview has inspired me. See you next time.